Hi there, and welcome back to the Who Goes There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Jessica from LSG Media, and we are going to be talking about Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, which won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 2001. So, Jessica, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's been kind of a long, complicated process because I think I sent out inquiries to everybody over at LSG like 2 years ago,
and got a long time.
Yeah, and so when I was looking at setting up my guests for this summer, I'm like, oh man, I totally forgot about the LSG folks. And Dean he'd signed up for The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, but just scheduling, he wasn't ever able to make time to do it. So. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that we finally got somebody from LSG Media because I really like what you guys do over there. So why don't you talk a little bit about yourself, about kind of some of your history as a science fiction fan and what you guys do at LSG Media?
Sure. So I am an occasional co-host on the LSG Media podcast. Typically, I do Game of Thrones, Westworld, Stranger Things. Once briefly did True Detective in the dark time of our lives that we were covering that. Occasionally I do a movie podcast, but not as much anymore. So that's kind of LSG Media. We do a lot of nerdy things. We used to just do science fiction. We've kind of branched out from there. Mm-hmm. Science fiction wise, I've definitely always been a little bit of a science fiction nerd. Han Solo was like my first like crush as a kid growing up when they did the re-release in 97. So that's one of my fond childhood memories. I've kind of always been a little into the nerdy, more sci-fi stuff. I've just been quiet about it in my younger life. And now as an adult, I can, just truly be nerdy and talk about how much I love sci-fi and Harry Potter and things of that nature. And it seems more, cool.
Yeah, it's more mainstream these days, especially with stuff like, Stranger Things, that is like a love letter to geek culture in so many ways.
Oh, I know. So good.
I found you guys, I don't know how many years ago it was, but I remember, one of the kind of the early highlights of my listening to the Science Fiction Film Podcast was when you were on to cover Primer.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that's still one of my favorite episodes that you guys have ever put out, just because you did such a good job untangling that movie, because it's very tangled.
Yeah, that's one of my proudest moments in pretty much my adult life is that podcast.
Yeah, that put you up in the pantheon for me, just for being able to comprehend, let alone break down that movie. So I was very impressed.
A lot of work went into that, for sure.
Yeah. Now, so... like we were talking before we started recording, it's a little strange with a lot of the Hugo winners, they're not necessarily obscure because the Hugo Awards are a fan vote, essentially, by the Worldcon membership. And so, but there are some of them that it's like, you really need to kind of dig into them and like, what's the context of this book? Where did it come from? Harry Potter isn't really that, right? It is by far the most popular of anything that I've seen on the list. So I feel like attacking this in the normal way that I would on the podcast might not serve it well. And so I want to dwell more on kind of, what's Harry Potter mean to you? What's your history with it as a whole? And we'll talk some about the specifics of the book as well. But let's start there. Where did you get involved with Harry Potter?
Sure. So I was not one of the people who was reading Harry Potter, the day it came out, like as a kid, whatever. I actually started reading Harry Potter after the first three books were out. So right before The Goblet of Fire came out, I was going into my freshman year of, no, I was in my freshman year of high school. And I went back and I'd had a friend who was like, you have to read Harry Potter. You have to read it. And I read the first three and I loved them. And I was super, super into it. And I went to a midnight release at a Walden Books in a mall to buy Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire the night it came out. People were wearing like shirts and like people were super into it already. I bought the book. It was the longest book at that time. It had been significantly longer than the other three books. It was definitely the longest of the four at that point. And I remember so well. I started the book. It was a weekend. I started on like a Friday night. I read a ton of it and I stayed all Saturday, like all day reading. I stayed up to like 3 in the morning and I read the whole book in 2 days. Like, that's all mm-hmm. I did for basically yeah. 2 days straight, and immediately loved it. And it is still to this day my favorite of all the Harry Potter books for sure.
Cool.
And I love Harry Potter. And yeah. I love the movies. Not my favorite Harry Potter movie, but that's probably because it's my favorite book.
Right.
It's hard to, separate that. But
it definitely can be. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is for sure. I think, and I feel pretty strongly about it, that it's my favorite of all the books. And I bet a lot of people would disagree, but I'll die on that hill. Like, I stand by it.
we can try and sell that during mm-hmm. the podcast. It's perfect. Funny because, I'm a bit older than you. I'm actually a couple years older than Dean. So I started picking these up right after The Goblet of Fire came out. Mm-hmm. And so I tore through the first three books and then happened to be visiting my aunt over in Idaho. We live in Oregon, and she has or at least at the time, she had like an online used book store.
Oh, that's so cool.
And so she had a shelf full of books, and she had The Goblet of Fire there. And so I picked it up while we were staying with them for just a couple of days, and kind of similar to you, just tore through it. While somehow managing not to ignore my family. That was interesting. And she let me take it with me too. So I got to bring it home. And I really enjoyed it. And after that, then I was I think The Order of the Phoenix was the first one that I bought in a store right after mm-hmm. it came out. I didn't go to like the pre-sale. I just went down to Fred Meyer or, some local store that happened to have it.
Right.
But then for books 6 and 7, I actually did the pre-order thing from Amazon. So, mm-hmm. I think when book 6 came out, I was working in my backyard, and the delivery man came to my fence and handed it off to me. And I'm like, all right, I'm done working for the day. I'm going to read
for a while. Very important.
Yes. Yeah. Cause I had a couple of these where like I'd be reading it at home and take it with me to work and read it on my lunch break, or like take a break and walk around the building or something, reading mm-hmm. the book.
right.
Trying not to fall over.
Yeah, very important.
So yeah, very readable. And, sometimes really popular books like Harry Potter get maligned because, they're just popular.
So popular.
They're not difficult to get into, right? They're super readable. And to me, I'm like, you know what? We need a balance of stuff that takes initiative and effort to read and stuff that's just a pleasure.
Right. And I do think that there's like almost like you say, when books are popular, people kind of like are like, oh, I don't know. Like, I feel like Stephen King is someone who falls into that like trap mm-hmm. where no one's ever going to be like, Stephen King is great literature because he's written so much. But some of the stuff he's written, I think, is as good as anything else I read in high school. And right. I feel like Harry Potter kind of, especially with all the movies and, that they're technically quote unquote kids books, which they're really not at all. But because of how they're marketed and how big they were, I feel like they almost don't get as much credit as they should sometimes, as far as
being absolutely
really good books and well written. And they are very easy to read. Not like watching Primer. It's very different.
Right. Yeah. you kind of have the two on the two poles, right? Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Stephen King, because I recently read Misery for another podcast I was on. And mm-hmm. in that one, it talks about, the kind of author proxy character there, who's an author, says he writes good books and bestsellers. And mm-hmm. I guess I get that philosophy. Mm-hmm. But kind of through that book, he comes to realize, you know what? The Misery books aren't that bad.
Right.
So I guess a question I kind of skipped over was when I initially sent out the inquiry about, hey, would you like to guest, you mm-hmm. picked Harry Potter with no hesitation. On this list of award-winning books. So why, is there a reason that you chose Harry Potter over all the rest of it?
It's funny, because at first when you sent out the list, I was like looking through and I thought about like, should I just pick a book I've never read and read it and go from there? But it almost seemed too good to be true. Like I said, it's my favorite Harry Potter book. I don't feel like mm-hmm. I've had enough of an opportunity to talk about Harry Potter. We did one podcast on it. We did on the movie Prisoner of Azkaban, which is mm-hmm. my favorite Harry Potter movie. So I've really lucked out as far as what we've covered or I've covered at this point. But I really haven't gotten a chance to talk about Harry Potter as much as I would like to. Nice. So it just seemed to work out perfectly. Like it was like a sign. I was like, oh, this will be good.
Right. A sign that 2 years later, you'd be on a podcast talking about
right,
it.
Right, right, right. By the time I forgot about it, then I was like, oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Cool. And you kind of mentioned your perspective on the series where Goblet of Fire is kind of the high watermark for you.
For me, yeah.
I feel like, you know, this is the point where she just kind of decided to keep making bigger and bigger books. And it works out with the Goblet of Fire, but then the Order of the Phoenix, I feel like, is the breaking point. And where, mm-hmm. where like, she decided she didn't need an editor anymore and that they'd just print whatever she wrote. And so right. that one ballooned up to 800 pages or something.
That's definitely a struggle, the getting too long. Like, you can have a really long book and it can be really good, but you can also go way too long. And that's yeah. Order of the Phoenix, for sure.
Yeah, where this one, and we can talk about it in spoilers, you know, I feel like there's a mm-hmm. couple subplots here that are mostly there to give a character something to do that doesn't have much to do. Mm-hmm. But the main plot of the book, I really do enjoy. And so let's kind of move into the non-spoiler discussion.
Sure.
And maybe this is the place where we've been talking about how, you know, Harry Potter books are these popular books that the hipsters don't want to read. Maybe try to convince somebody who hasn't read any Harry Potter books. Maybe they've just seen the movies.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I think that Harry Potter to me is like, defines kind of like a genre and again, mm-hmm. children's fantasy book, quote unquote, whatever. But it's not that at all. It's actually a really, really smart, well done book that hits on a lot of very like serious themes. And I feel like Prisoner of Azkaban is a similar way, but this book definitely like hits upon some darker themes, touches upon a lot of really emotional stuff. The kids are getting older. So they're getting to an age where even reading it as an adult or as a hipster, you're going to be able to relate. You remember what it was like to be a teenager and
right.
going to your like first dance and stuff like that and liking someone and not knowing if they like you back. Like even as an adult, all those feelings are things that you can relate to. I can understand going back and reading, you know, The Sorcerer's Stone and being like, I don't care about these kids and their adventures. They're like seven.
Yeah.
But by the time you get to this point, I feel like there's going to be somebody you relate to because the character development, especially of like your main three, but also outside characters as well, is very, very well done. Mm. And if you like adventure, if you like sci-fi, that's great. But if you don't, I still think there's something to be found here for pretty much anyone. I definitely think yeah. it transcends genre for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you're talking about some of the deeper themes, there's stuff that, you know, is quite relevant today about the way the media is handled and, and, you know, the whole fake news thing. There's definitely that comes in. We can talk more about that in spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. And with this book being as old as it is and as well known as it is because of the movies, I feel like, does it matter if we, you know, give a spoiler warning? I'm not sure
yeah.
it does.
I know it's tough because it's like, at this point, if you haven't seen the movie or read the book, I mean, you know,
Yeah, it's on you at this point, right?
But there's somebody out there who's going to be like, how dare you spoil Harry Potter, this book from 2000. Unacceptable. Right. I didn't read it 19 years ago.
Right. Yeah, man, when you put that number on it, that...
I know. It makes me feel so old.
Yeah, yeah. I don't really need that to make me feel old. I've got a 17-year-old kid, so... Well, on that note, why don't we go ahead and just dive into spoilers and we can talk about, you know, whatever you want to talk about, plot points, themes. I wanted to talk about at some point, you know, why do you think this book in particular won the Hugo Award when, you know, all the books were quite popular and,
right.
and good?
Mm-hmm. I do find that interesting that this was the only one to win, especially because of the popularity. And, you know, as I've said, it's my favorite. And I wonder if, again, there's something to, I can go back and reread this book and still love it. I can't go back and reread Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone because it's boring to me now. It's essentially just like setting up, this is the world that you're going to see. There's not as much of a plot. They're like, here are your characters. Here's this world. Here's kind of a plot, but not really. I mean, there's a plot, but you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of continues from there. I think this book has a lot of like reread like ability to it, like where you could go back and read it again. It's still interesting. I do think that it's something that, like I said, hits a lot of different points. It's fantasy and sci-fi, but there's a lot of adventure to it. The whole, you know, tournament and everything like that, I think is exciting. It's something different. It's not like the Hunger Games, but it's like a book like the Hunger Games is popular, where you have this like tournament, and these people in this competition, and who's going to win and what's the end result. And I think people like that too. I also think there's a lot of different characters and things that are set up in this book that are important for things later on. But the later books did start to get a little, I don't know, almost a little draggy. I do feel like that there's something to the fact of at this point, like J.K. Rowling is kind of at the top of where she was going to go. And I think it was very hard to follow up. I think it's hard to follow up a book like this. And I think Order of the Phoenix is probably my worst favorite of all the books.
Yeah, I agree.
Really overall, because it's hard to read and a lot of it is unnecessary. It's just filling pages, a chunk of it, I think. Whereas I don't feel that way with this for the most part. I feel like most of this is really, really well done. And I love the character development of the kids like getting older. And I think that is something that really makes this book stand apart. It feels real where they're in the middle of this crazy war, but they're still like kids. Whereas when you start to get to the later books, it's just dark and war and like whatever. And the earlier books, it's like, they're just kids. This book and like Prisoner of Azkaban, it's really like, okay, we're still kids, you know, just trying to live our lives and pass our exams. But there's also this bigger thing that we have to deal with. And I like that. I like both aspects being such a big part of the book, as opposed to it just being one or the other. Like you get on either end, I guess. That makes sense.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, when I was trying to think about, you know, why this one win the Hugo, I was thinking about the fact that it does do some world building with, you know, kind of builds out the wizarding world by adding the, you know, Durmstrang and Beauxbatons academies, right? And just the idea, oh, you know, hey, is there one of these in the US? You know, it makes you kind of think about those kind of things. But the main thing I think is that and this is kind of where it leads to in the other books losing their way a little bit, is now we have Voldemort kind of joining the series as a regular cast member, right? He's not just in the background anymore. He's back. And in the next couple books, you have to wrestle with, well, okay, if he's back, where is he? What's he doing? You know, why hasn't the war really heated up now that
he's like
back?
A really valid point, actually. And it's funny. And you're right. Once he's actually back, like that's, you're building to that point where he's going to be back for four books. And once he's back, you're also like, now we're going to have a bunch more books where he's back, but we're not going to defeat him for like thousands of pages, which is, you know, it's like a different story you're telling. This is almost the climax of a series in a way where it's like, oh, he's here, he's back. That's actually a really good point.
Yeah. It's funny because you talked about how, you know, the kids are growing up and it feels realistic. And some of it, I feel like, I don't love manufactured tension in books. And so I'm reading this one and I'm like, you know, when Ron's being all pissy about, you know, Harry being in the tournament, it's clearly just jealousy. And I look at it as an adult and I'm like, oh, come on, you guys just hug it out or something.
Right.
I mean, I'm kind of a reconciler anyway. I've never liked the feeling of holding a grudge or someone being angry at me. And so I was always the kid who would, you know, get in this knockdown dragout fight with somebody. And then I'd be like, hey, we okay? You know, and then, you know, my sisters would be like, I'm not talking to you. So even though I kind of look at it and I'm like, oh, I hate that, you know, that Ron and Harry aren't on the same page for a quarter of the book, but you know, they're 14 years old. And so I totally do get it. It's realistic in that sense.
I think it's like really actually very, in tune with like Ron's character of always being like secondary. And he's in especially, you know, in the big family, with Harry being popular and everything like that. We know he likes Hermione, and now we've got Hermione with this other guy, Victor Crumb. So there's so much of that, like throughout Ron as a character. And I also think it builds to like, you know, in later books where he like really lets that like jealousy kind of like take over, more so. But like, I think that's like, that's within his character that he's kind of been that way his whole life, where he's never been like the center of attention or the one in any circumstance. which is why I love him and Hermione, and I ship them, obviously. because I love Hermione, obviously. I love Ron. Ron was like probably one of, you know, my absolute favorite characters.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Hermione, because like I'm reading this book and I'm like, how come Hermione isn't the main character? I mean, she's better at everything than everybody, it seems like.
Oh my God, I know.
Yeah. So
Hermione's the best, for sure.
She is, and yet she doesn't have all that much to do in this book. And that's where I kind of hinted at earlier with the, you know, the elf liberation thing and mm-hmm. her going after Rita Skeeter, which I actually like that subplot better, where she's doing something useful, right? She's like, wait, how is she getting these stories? And I thought that was an interesting way that came out.
Right. I agree with you that subplot is better. Like the elf thing, almost like whatever. And it is, that's something where it's like, okay, we're doing something to do something. The Rita Skeeter stuff. And like you were saying, like the fake news and how like that's so like prevalent now. And like this book was really like, hey, we're going to do a lot of this fake news stuff, which is funny that in, you know, 2000, that was still a big concern or already a big concern.
A bit, yeah.
But it is true that Hermione definitely kind of got a back seat to some degree in this book, where she is, again, smarter than every single person in like the entire series, basically. Which is interesting. I think because maybe it's so not action heavy, but the Triwizard Tournament is such a big part of it. They're like, it's hard to fit her in the way they probably want to. Which is unfortunate, to be honest. But
yeah, I thought it was emblematic of kind of her role in the book, that moment when Ron turns to her and is like, hey, you're a girl, aren't you? She's like, oh, you worked it out, did you?
I know, so funny. I love the interactions. I love like Hermione's interactions with pretty much everybody, because I feel like she typically has the upper hand in them. She's funny. She's got a very good like sense of self, even from the start, where there's a lot of like growing in characters, figuring things out, and her too. But I feel like she always has like a strong sense of self, like Hermione, which I like about her as a character. It's very interesting. It's funny because Harry's kind of the most boring of like the main three as far as a character goes, which is
right. Well, I mean, he's the reluctant hero, right? He doesn't want this,
and yet
it's always thrust upon him, and so you can kind of see why that tension between Ron and Harry makes sense, where Ron sees that Harry's always in the spotlight, and Harry's like, I don't want the spotlight, but he does have it, and
so right.
I was looking at it, I'm like, you know, there's something in there about like privilege, whether it's, you know, white privilege or any other kind of privilege, where Harry has it, and just because he doesn't want it doesn't change the fact that he has it.
Correct. Yeah, that's a very, very valid point. And it is a constant thing, and that is a very big disconnect of being like, I don't want this privilege, and someone being like, but you still have it, and I wish I did. Right. Whereas, you know, looking at Harry, where he's like, I don't want this thing, and Ron's like, but I'd take it. Like, I'd take it if it was given to me, and maybe he wouldn't if the circumstances were that way. But it's a hard way to interact between two people, especially when Harry kind of often gets the things that like Ron wants from like the start of like with Quidditch and all of that. It's always kind of been Ron playing second fiddle and Harry being like, I don't want these things. But especially in this, like the Triwizard Tournament and everything, where, you know, Harry's not even supposed to be eligible to compete. It's only supposed to be the one person. And, you know, obviously there's going to be magic involved, and we're going to find out, you know, that it's actually a terrible thing. Which is funny because, like Cedric Diggory is like a character like that, like his death and everything around it was like very impactful for me when I was younger. And I read this originally, like I cried when I read this book, when Dumbledore gives his speech at the end. And I like still remember, and I actually haven't read the book in a little while at this point. But Dumbledore gives his speech and he says, you know, sometimes someone needs to make the choice between what's right and what's easy. And like, even now when I think about it, it like gives me goosebumps. Like there was something so impactful about that for me, and about this book being like, hey, here's this character that did nothing wrong. And he just was picked to do this tournament. He was basically like a jock, and he's dead now, and this is sad. Like, yeah. This is what we're going to do now in this book. Like, we're serious, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, I'm a dad, and so, you know, I come at it from that side too. When Cedric gets killed and his family is there, and I'm just like, that's horrifying.
It is like painful. It's really sad, and it's very. And again, that's when you're like, okay, like this book, you know, and you start it with Prisoner of Azkaban being like much darker, and but you also at the end of the day, you don't, you know, Sirius Black gets away, and you don't actually lose a character that like that. And in this book, they're like, okay, here is this kid, he is dead now.
Gloves are off at this point.
Right. And again, it's like the pinnacle where you reach the top, and like once you do that, you can only go a certain way. The same thing with like Voldemort being back. You've reached, like, you're like, oh, we built to this point where we're like, we're going to kill characters, and Voldemort's back, and things are about to get crazy.
Let's lighten it up a little bit here. Getting pretty heavy. As I understand it, Victor Crumb, the character, was actually added to give J.K. Rowling a way to tell Americans how to pronounce Hermione.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Yeah.
'Cause I remember I had no idea how her name was pronounced when I read the first couple books.
I feel like nobody did.
Yeah.
I think everybody pronounced it. I don't even remember how I think I used to say, like, in my head, like Hermione or something. Like, I definitely never said Hermione.
Yeah, definitely. Now I always say Hermanini, just because the way Crumb did.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. It's so true, though, with a name like that. And everybody else has like super like normal names. Like they're like, oh, this is Harry and Ron and Fred and George and Ginny and Hermione. And she's the muggle, too, of all of them to have the weirdest name. That's so funny. That was helpful. I remember that, like him trying to pronounce her name and her explaining it. Victor Crumb was funny for a useless character. Not useless. Like he was. He served a purpose, but there was a lot of like good humor that came out of like him being a character in the book. He was good, like comedic relief, I feel. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of Victor Crumb, like in Ron, like playing with his like action figure or whatever, like because he was pissed off.
Yeah. That he completely goes off him after Crumb takes a fancy to Hermione.
Yep. So funny. It's so funny. Yeah. It was good. It was good comedic relief. Like I really liked Victor Crumb as like a comedic character in this book. I think they did a really good job with that, honestly. Yeah. I found him very entertaining.
Yeah. One character I found interesting was, of course, Mad-Eye Moody, who is not actually Mad-Eye Moody, but is still this very compelling character in the book. And so we get the experience with Harry in the following books, feeling like he and we already know Mad-Eye when we actually meet him, even though we actually don't. So I thought that was fascinating. And you know, this one, like we've said, ups the ante on some things and going through the unforgivable curses, right? Pretty much in every book, there's some kind of new thing where in the, I can't remember what it was in the first movie, but like in the Prisoner of Azkaban, the whole animagus and werewolf, that comes into it. Where in this one you have the unforgivable curses, and so you're like, well, those are all going to be used at some point in this movie because that's, or not in this movie, in this book,
yeah.
Because that's usually what happens, right? They establish here's a thing that exists, and now that's going to become the major plot point.
Right, and it's. And like you said, you're like, okay, no, this is going to be a thing. And this is just what started the, also like the defense against the dark arts teachers are bad. Like at this point, you're like, oh, this is not looking good.
Yes.
But yeah, Mad-Eye Moody it's very interesting how they do this. And like you say, you feel like, oh, I know him, but you really didn't know him. It's like, you have to learn. The book is like smart about stuff like that and how they introduce like characters in different ways and how they, the introduction of like the plot points, unforgivable curses, that type of things. Doesn't he like, he does something like to Draco, Malfoy for.
Yeah, he turns him into like a ferret.
Yes, that's what it is, a ferret. I was like, what kind of animal was it? Yeah. It's definitely. I like Mad-Eye Moody as a character. I feel like that's definitely they do such a good job with like creating these different people and like their place in the books and like the bigger world. And And I like the fact that the real Mad-Eye Moody was alive. Like, it wasn't just like taken over and, you know what I mean? Like, that we still get the actual character too. So you get a chance to get to know both in a way.
Right. Yeah. And I was kind of reading it this time, almost like the second time you watch The Sixth Sense, where you're looking for all the clues.
Yes.
And, you know, credit where it's due. I don't feel like there's a ton of clues that would lead you to thinking Mad-Eye's actually somebody else. But once you know that he is, then you're like, well, why would he be helping Harry in this situation? But right. I feel like it really does hold together quite well, where you could just be like, well, you know, he's just a cool teacher, right? Where he's not going to rat out Harry just because he can see through his invisibility cloak.
Right.
He's not going to let Filch know that he's actually caught him out of class.
Yeah, it is interesting. And it's funny. Like I said, it's been a little bit since I've read it, but it is, that's such, like going back and looking for it. I don't remember feeling any time I've read it where I've been like, all right, obviously, like now that I know, I definitely think they did a good job with how it was written, where it also wasn't like you go back and you're like, oh, they screwed up here, which is what I want. Like when you rewatch The Sixth Sense, I was like, I can't wait to see where they screwed up. Right. Which they didn't really in that movie either, but, it is fun to go back and read something when you know what the twist is, or to read or watch and to look for the way they hint at things. And that's definitely a good one. Like the Mad-Eye Moody, not being Mad-Eye Moody, scenario.
Yeah. I mean, I guess at this point it's just, if you have any other, you know, themes or plot points you want to talk about, we can do that.
Nothing too super specific. It's hard to, where you basically don't really need to get super specific about this type of thing. But just overall, I like the little bit of coming of age feeling it has to it with the characters growing up, and you know, life just getting more serious. I really feel like there's some really good character development of the leads. And even in general, like other outside characters, I think that this book, and being like the length that it is, it really gives you the opportunity to delve into a lot of different things with a lot of different people. And this was definitely the point in the series where you had to do that. And I think J.K. Rowling does a really good job of that. In this book, I think after this book, there are some struggles, but yes. In this book, I really feel like she does a good job of using this large amount of space she has to tell a good story and to really set her characters up for their futures, basically, in the series. So it's definitely worth reading. That is for sure. I would always highly recommend it.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to talk about was kind of looping back to the whole fake news thing and the government not wanting to be upfront and honest about the situations. It reminded me of watching Chernobyl recently. Cornelius Fudge at the end of this book is just like that reactor chief, you know. He's like saying, well, Voldemort can't be back, therefore he is not back. You know,
right.
It's only 3.6 Rentgen. It's not great, not terrible. we sure though. Just like the unwillingness to admit, to publicly say, yeah, Voldemort is back. And I love the fact that Dumbledore is just like, you know what? Screw these guys. I'm not going to sit on this. I'm going to give these kids the information that they need. And then it's extremely frustrating in the next book where, you know, half the people just don't believe him. They think Harry Potter's making it up.
Right. Oh, super frustrating. Yeah. And you know, it is, I love that about this book, that when they're all in denial and like Dumbledore is like forever, like the good guy and the hero. And he's like, no, like everybody needs to know, but it is hard. It's like with anything, when nobody like believes a character about something that you know is true, especially a character that you have no reason to distrust per se, it's like super frustrating. But somebody like a politician, someone in power wanting to say, no, this person's not really back. Like, that's not how it is. Like, nobody panic.
Right.
Makes sense. Like, that to me is so logical. It's so frustrating, but I feel like that's exactly how things are, which is sad, but true.
Yeah, pretty much. It's interesting how relevant, both the government kind of side of things and the media side of things. I'm like, yeah, boy, that is still, mm-hmm. Especially now, very relevant.
I think so. And it's almost like at the time where this book comes out, it's, I guess probably 2000, there were probably a lot of these themes that you were starting to see. But now, like so much so, looking back on it, there's so much that back then, was being written about and was an idea and was an issue enough where, J.K. Rowling's putting it as part of her book. And to see that now it's still so, so relevant, like the themes in this book are still relevant now, 19 years later or whatever. Which is also, that's the great thing about sci-fi, I feel like, in general, mm-hmm. because sci-fi is so broad and there's so much you can do and there's so many themes you can touch upon that it's harder to do in like a realistic type of book that mm-hmm. I feel like they stand the test of time a lot better. And this is like a good example of that.
One kind of a comedic moment. I mean, it wouldn't have fit in the book at all, right? The whole idea of the prior incantatum or whatever it is, where the wands meet and the wand's browser cache is exposed. I felt like in a lesser book there would have been some embarrassing spell that popped out of somebody's wand. But
I know you would think, right?
Yep. Like, what were you doing with that spell exactly? But
if she had like 10 more pages, like maybe we would have seen that.
I'm not sure that would have really fit for Voldemort,
No.
A couple dead people and then like teddy bears, because he needed comfort.
Yeah. Yeah, that wouldn't have exactly worked, but.
No, probably she got the tone better than I would have.
Yeah, so. Yeah. She had it. She had it down.
I had a prior guest on who, when we were wrapping up, he's like, hey, if you want me to come back and talk about Harry Potter, I can, and we can talk about how it shouldn't have won the Hugo over A Storm of Swords.
Should or shouldn't have?
Shouldn't have.
Okay.
He felt like that was an injustice that Harry Potter won over one of the Song of Ice and Fire books, but
I definitely think that's, and I'm sure now especially, and I have to be honest, I haven't read any of the Game of Thrones books. I watched the show first, and once I started, and especially once we started podcasting, I'm like, I'm not going to go back and read the books now. That's kind of been my my thing, is that I hadn't. And I just wonder if maybe it's because it reaches a bigger audience. To some degree, but then again, none of the other Harry Potter books won. But that was my thought at the time, because I think in the email you sent me, you mentioned something about it winning over A Storm of Swords. And I was trying to think, and I wonder if it's because it's more accessible.
Probably. And I mean, we kind of talked through where we felt like this one takes it up a notch from the previous books.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hugo Award is a fan vote. And so, fans are capricious. You can't tell what they're going to do.
Have any of the other Game of Thrones books won?
No.
A Hugo? No. Huh. That's interesting.
No. Maybe something like World Fantasy Award, something like that, or Nebula's, but I don't think the Hugo. I mean, I know it's not, I know there aren't any of them on the Hugo's because I have a list.
Yes. And it is not on it. You don't have to read it in your quest. Yep.
I read the first Game of Thrones book. I guess it's a Game of Thrones, right?
Yes.
But after that, I mean, fantasy isn't really my thing for the most part. I do like some of the kind of young adult fantasy like this and the Rick Riordan stuff. But I've never been a huge fan of like Lord of the Rings or Terry Pratchett books or Terry Brooks or any of those.
Lord of the Rings, that's like sacrilege to not, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I have read Lord of the Rings 2.5 times. I've read all of them twice, and then I started reading them aloud to my son, and I got halfway through the Two Towers where it finishes off the first book of the Two Towers, and he said, I'm really bored, can we not read this anymore? And so, I'm like, should I go back and keep reading just so I can say I've read them 3 times? But
oh my gosh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
I'm bored.
Yeah. They are a little dull in places. But
does your son like Harry Potter?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Although, I always found that Harry Potter did not work very well as read alouds. Somehow the prose didn't flow as well. Okay, so how about final thoughts about Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire?
Honestly, I'm glad I got to come on and talk about it. I really think it's a book that has a lot of good to it. I think it's a great series. I think the series, the Harry Potter series as a whole, really changed a lot of just what was popular and what people were interested in. Just kind of like Game of Thrones has sort of done that and brought like fantasy and that like darker fantasy to a new light. I feel like Harry Potter and how big it was is the reason why we have, you know, the Hunger Games being such a big thing and like people Absolutely. Wanting to watch fantasy and to see that type of thing. Like any show where magic's involved or movie, I feel like this opened a door to a genre that was not, people weren't interested in. It wasn't popular like this. Before Harry Potter, a lot of the things that come out now, I feel like you couldn't have made it. People wouldn't have gone to see it. And now it's all, it's like, it's cool now. Like it's cool to like fantasy a little bit.
Right. And the younger audience too, right? The whole young adult fantasy, you know, things like Twilight obviously owe a debt to it as well.
Yes.
I'm not a fan of.
Sure.
I remember one time walking into Barnes and Noble and there was a whole section labeled paranormal teen romance. Oh man, this is where we've come as a society.
No, it's so true though. Like that's like, and people watch like The Vampire Diaries and all those, like those teen, like young adult series now that are coming out that people are into, but you're also creating a culture where these teens that are reading Twilight and The Vampire Diaries and like, True Blood is like another example. That's going to be people who grow up and are like more willing to watch science fiction-y fantasy things. Whereas when I was growing up, nobody, like that was not cool. Like you didn't go and see like movies like that. It wasn't cool. Like when Star Wars was out, that was cool. And then it was like, it's really not cool to like nerdy shit. And I don't know if I can swear on this podcast. I've tried.
Generally, I don't, but.
I tried hard not to. And that just came out. but now I feel that there is more of an audience and people are more willing to accept and to try different things that I don't think were always accessible. It made this genre accessible to way more people. And I think, you know, the fantasy, especially the young adult fantasy genre, like really owes a debt to J.K. Rowling because it has gotten so big because she wrote these books. And then all of a sudden people were like, this is cool. Like, I like this. So I think that's really telling. And maybe this book wins the Hugo because it's the best of the bunch, like I think.
Right.
And it's just a commentary on the fact that this series as a whole, like really changed, I feel like, how the genre was viewed.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. It's almost like a lifetime achievement award, right?
Right.
Right. Although I think we've gone over some reasons, I feel like, why this one is deserving at this point in the series, but also like at some point, just recognizing the Harry Potter phenomenon was gonna need to happen.
Right. For sure. And I'm glad that this is the book that they chose to do it with. I'm glad they didn't wait until the end and they were like, all right, maybe the Half-Blood Prince. Like I like that this is the book that represents Harry Potter on this list. I think that is, it's obviously what I agree with, but just in general, like I'm happy. I feel like it's a good representation of the series as a whole and what it brings to the table.
Yes. Cool. Well, where can people get a hold of you if they want to, or, you know, find out more about LSG Media?
So I am terrible at Twitter and Instagram, so you can't follow me in any of those places. You can definitely
and not really that great at email either.
No, terrible. I do not check my LSG Media email ever. I am on Facebook, so you can find me on Facebook. I will accept people as friends. And if you look up LSG Media, either on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, that will bring you to the podcast and you can find me through there. And then you can check that out if you want to.
LSG Media stands for Liberty Street Geek, right?
Yes. The website is libertystreetgeek.net, I believe.
Okay, cool. And that's a reference to something in Massachusetts, right?
Not exactly. That's not exactly a reference to something like Dean considered his philosophy when he started the podcast.
Okay.
That's gotcha. A very old name from a long time ago.
Oh, fascinating. I was just assumed it was some Northeastern reference I didn't get.
Nope. That's a reference that probably only Dean gets.
Okay. All right. Yeah, learn something new every day.
Yeah, same.
Well, Jessica, I really want to thank you for doing this. I appreciate you hanging in there, even though I left you hanging for 2 years and for dealing with trying to get this scheduled. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. And I know scheduling it this week was tough, but I'm glad that we found time and managed to get it done.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been able to talk about Harry Potter in a long time. So this was a delight.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Yeah, no, it was fun. I'm glad that we got to do it.
All right. Well, I'm sure I'll see you guys on social media and you can ignore my emails.
Okay.
From here on.
I will do that. Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Jessica, and I definitely recommend that you check out the Science Fiction Film Podcast and everything else that they do over at Liberty Street Geek. I will warn you, the content there does check the box for explicit, so be warned about that if you're going to head over there. But they really have some great podcasts and great insight that they bring to all their podcasts, and great humor as well. So make sure to check them out. As always, you can follow me on Twitter at Hugo's Podcast. And you can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. You can use the contact form up on hugospodcast.com. If you want to get a hold of me, I can always use new guests. I'm actually kind of in the market right now for trying to plan out my guests for the fall. So if you want a guest on here, or if you have a suggestion for me, let me know. If you would like to support the work that I'm doing here and in my other podcasts, you can go to patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast and become a patron. All right, I think that's going to do it for this time, so thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.
I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one at a time. Oh, sorry. Of course I'm reading them one at a time. It's hard to read them two at a time. I just realized I forgot what year this won the Hugo, so.
Oh, God.
And that's part of my intro.